Hey, friends, just a quick little note before we get into the episode. I just want to give you a little heads up. As you'll be able to tell by the very first topic that we discussed, Bill and I actually recorded this a while ago. We talk about Scott Kelly, you know, the astronaut that was in space for a year. Yeah, this was a while ago, but I thought it was still interesting enough to include. So just keep in mind, I know this happened a while ago. We're all on board with that, but I still think it's pretty engaging. Hopefully you will as well. Thanks.
Clock has started.
Yes, sir. Reading you loud and clear.
Ask a rocket scientist.
7 years. Fuel is go. 4G. 5.5 cabin. Oxygen go. All systems are go.
Well, welcome to another episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist. My name is Chuck Woodford, and I am an idiot. And I've got my genius rocket science friend, Bill Scaff, here. Say hi, Bill.
How's it going, Chuck?
Just fine, thank you. It's really great to have you available to answer questions, because I've got two kids that are of the age where everything is a question for them, most of them science-related, and I just don't have the basic knowledge. I mean, I'm a grown man. I should have this knowledge, but I do not, so I'm glad that I have you to fall back on.
Well, I'm here for you, Chuck.
It's nice of you to say, Bill. All right, so very first thing I want to talk about, recently, the kids and I have been paying attention to Scott Kelly in space, the International Space Station, the astronaut that was on the space station for almost a full year. We watched, we followed him on Facebook and all of his posts there and Instagram, and followed his return to Earth. And so my kids have got questions, and so do I. Mike, the initial question is, okay, I understand why we wanted to have him and then the Russian astronaut that was with him that was also there for the same amount of time, 340 days. Like, I understand why. Because when we go to Mars, we're going to be in space and weightless for a much longer time than a year. So what do we hope to gain by having Scott Kelly in space for a year? Like, what do you think we're going to end up learning?
So I think what they're trying to find is, we've had astronauts in space for, as Americans, we've had them up for 6 months, a little over 6 months. Russians have had them up much longer than 1 year. In the past, though, we haven't, like in these long-duration missions that the Russians have done, they didn't monitor their health they monitor their health, but not the medical details.
Heart rate, things like that?
The basics they did, but when you're trying to go to Mars, you have to figure out, basically you want to, we say there's a knee in the curve. It's where when the data kind of falls off and humans get in trouble.
A knee in the curve?
Yeah, it's like if you plot a curve, it's not straight line. It's like, it's like you're going along merrily on your way, and then suddenly your body gives up and things go bad real quickly.
Okay.
They're trying to establish.
So it's not a gradual descent. It literally is like a.
No, and that's.
The curve just drops as you go insane.
Pretty much. And that's what they're trying to find. Honestly, okay. That's it. NASA's right. Had.
What's
NASA
the breaking point for the human
exactly.
Psyche?
Exactly. Is there a point where not just. You touch on something important here is the psychology of this is. Very important, because you're in a very small confined space for a long time. So there's the mental aspect as well as the physical aspect, and you're subject to all the perils of space. Space is not forgiving. I mean, the radiation out there can kill you in a heartbeat. The space station is relatively safe because it's protected partially by the Earth's magnetosphere. So it's not truly out there on its own. It's got partial protection. But when we transit from Earth to Mars, that's another risk, because there'll be a lot more radiation we have to deal with. Mm-hmm. So if in the articles you've seen with Scott Kelly, and they're always talking about, are the radiation effects on him? What are the physiological and psychological effects? And they're trying to just get more data. This is the most scrutinized endurance flight for any astronauts ever, both for the Russian cosmonaut and our astronaut, Scott Kelly.
And so do we have any idea what to expect as far as any physical changes or his physiology? Bone structure, I mean, because...
Right. And they do. And they have an idea. Things they've found since the beginning of astronauts is when you're in weightless, we're singly designed to be in a gravity environment. So as soon as you take gravity away, our body says, oh, I don't need the bones anymore. It starts mm-hmm. decalcifying.
Yeah.
Your heart doesn't have to work as hard. Your neck, your back muscles start atrophying, and because they're not needed.
Yeah, well, I think last episode we touched on the fact that when you're weightless, you don't know that you have to go to the bathroom.
Exactly.
Because you don't have that pressure in your bladder, your
exactly.
bowel saying, hello,
right.
time to vacate.
Exactly, because they're designed under a gravity environment. It's supposed to, the fluid pushes down. Well, in space, fluid kind of goes to the center of a container. It doesn't touch the walls.
Huh.
So suddenly you don't know you have to pee
right.
until it's way too late.
Way too late.
Way too late.
And that's no good.
No. Other things that happen is the shape of your eye changes in zero G. And so some astronauts have had commented they've had some visual symptoms when they come back to Earth, and it takes time for their eyes to recover. Like the acuity, visual acuity is impacted.
Yeah.
And so if you're thinking, okay, we're going to Mars, you're going to be on a ship getting out there, at its best case is 6.5 months, let's say, using current chemical engines. Zero G, you've got to function when you get to the other end. And so if you're going to be out there for 6 months, you know, even longer, if it's a slow moving ship, large ship, you know, you don't want your astronauts impaired. As soon as they put foot on the ground, they don't have the time to, you know, recuperate.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that up, because the one thing that the kids and I noticed is that when Scott Kelly landed, you saw the footage of, you know, the capsule opens, he's there, they pull the visor back, he's like, hey, yeah, this is great. But there's like a whole bunch of guys that lift him out of the craft and carry him over, because his body's just not used to carrying his own weight, right? His bones, so would his bones be more brittle, or they would just need, the muscles would need to flex a little bit more to gain more strength to be able to support his weight?
I believe they actually are, if you want to think of them as a little bit weaker, which, you know, could be interpreted as being brittle, because they're decalcifying, so they're losing strength. So Scott Kelly obviously wouldn't get out of the capsule and go running around. You know, his bones aren't, you know, his bones, or neither his muscles or the bones are capable of doing it at this point. Right. And that's why, you know, you always see them, you know, lift them out, put them in those recliner chairs, and they move them in the recliner chairs out to the, there's actually a medical tent nearby.
Yeah.
And they start doing medical debrief, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And with Scott Kelly, it's especially important because they wanted a lot of data from the minute he got back to Earth. So this isn't the usual medical debrief. I mean, they went and started pulling blood. They started doing things right away, as fast as they can get into that tent.
This is like a full body profile, full health profile.
Exactly, exactly. And the neat thing about Scott Kelly is he has a twin brother, Mark Kelly, who's also an astronaut.
Yes.
And so they've been benchmarking all the tests before they even flew, before Scott went to space. They benchmarked them against each other and got, you know, their full profiles. And they put them through the same sort of tests as time progressed over the year to see.
Really?
Yeah, they benchmarked them against each other.
So his brother's name is Mark, right?
Right.
And so,
identical twin.
So while Scott was in space doing certain activities, like if he was on a spacewalk, they would have Mark here on Earth kind of...
Not necessarily from an activity perspective, but they would constantly take measurements on both of them to try to see...
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So think of your control. Mark acted as the control group because he's an identical twin, same genetics.
Right.
Right.
His environment hasn't changed at all.
Hasn't changed at all.
Okay.
So, and that becomes important because we're talking radiation. Radiation. Because that can alter your genetic code.
Mm-hmm.
And so if Scott's being impacted by radiation, they'd hopefully start seeing it as they did, you know, test both of them.
Got it.
And catch them as a deviation.
So let's talk about what it's like, because last episode we did talk about how quickly we could get there using different propulsion systems, how long it would take now and how long it would take 20 years from now. So I've heard it said that if we send from launch to return to Earth, probably 2 years, 2.5 years round trip. Does that sound accurate?
Right. So I think what they think is the most, well, there's two, I guess, concepts that are plausible right now. So if you launch when Earth and Mars are in perfect alignment with a chemical engine with what we have now, about 6.5 months to get out there, maybe a little faster.
Okay.
The problem is by the time you get to Mars, Mars is now misaligned with Earth. So you get very little time there, and you have to return to have any chance of getting back to Earth, or you have to ride Mars around for 18 months and then return launch.
Oh my
so
goodness.
Your missions are a little over a year or 3 years.
Okay, so 6.5 months, let's say, to get there. And then how long is the window to be on Mars before you have to get back and wait the 18 months?
It's like less than a week. It's very short.
So it's a couple days.
Yeah, it's not very long. And then your return trip is much longer because you're launching in an inopportune alignment between Mars and Earth. So that's where better propulsion methods would allow you to get out there, have more time on Mars, and still return without having to ride Mars around for half a year.
Got it.
Before you can return launch. And so that's the reason why many of the initial concepts to go to Mars aren't going to actually have us landing on Mars. They're going to have us landing on one of its moons.
Okay.
You have Phobos and Deimos.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a couple of benefits. One, you don't have to fight Mars' gravity well. It's a lot easier to get off the moon than it is to get off of Mars.
Okay.
Simplifies your equipment and so forth. So I think that's the more likely or more plausible first mission scenario is go to one of the moons.
So just like when we had the Apollo program, Apollo 8 got us to the moon. We did an orbit or a slingshot around it and came right back. There wasn't any landing. Right. We didn't orbit. We didn't stay for a long time. We just needed to prove that we could do it.
Right.
So what you're saying is that the first trip to Mars is probably going to be something like that.
Very piecewise.
6.5 months out, then either landing on a moon or orbiting a moon, do you think? What's the...
Right. And it all depends on exactly. So remember, Apollo was very conservative. So Apollo 8 first went into orbit. You know, you progressed from Apollo 8 to Apollo 10, where you got up there, you had the lander with you, you didn't do anything with it, you just were in Earth orbit, you did things with it. Finally, Apollo 10 went
moon
all
orbit.
The way... No, Earth orbit. Apollo 8 didn't leave Earth orbit, but it brought all the equipment up, and they tested it in Earth orbit. Then you progressed to Apollo 10, which actually went all the way around the moon, actually decoupled the lander. Lander went down to 47,000 feet above the surface, but that was it. They simulated a landing... 47,000 feet off the surface.
Without actually touching down.
They did not touch down. Okay. And then they went back up and they learned a lot from Apollo 10, which helped make Apollo 11 a success. So they were very conservative as they approached this. They didn't just, you know, let's go to the moon first. They piecewise approached it. Now, with the cost of a Mars mission, they can't be quite as conservative.
Right.
You know, because we can't build these ships.
Because we're not going to be able to send them up every 5 or 6 months like we did with the Apollo program.
No, definitely not. It'd be... Right now, they're thinking the rocket that's needed to get one of these missions off the ground, they probably don't have money to build one any more rapidly than every 3 years.
Okay.
So you probably wouldn't see a mission, an exploration mission, more frequently than every 3 years.
And so we would. So if we launch, so the very first time we launch an expedition to Mars, it would be they would go out, they would do their thing, and then they would come back.
Right.
And then we would do the second launch. We would never have two missions going simultaneously, one of them passing the other.
It wouldn't be likely, because again, it's cost prohibitive, I would believe, would be one of your biggest reasons. It would be nice if you could, because if you had two SLS rockets launching, you know, a few months apart from each other, but that means you've built two of them nearly parallel to each other, and I don't know if they have any capability doing that.
Right. Okay. So it would be one trip at a time.
Right.
We'd return, several months would pass, and then the next
week. Right. If not years, most likely, yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is fascinating, and so we're going to be doing this in a year or two, right? This is one of the...
Oh, yeah, right. Depending on who you talk to.
2020, right? We're going
to
be
2020 seems to be more plausible for Orion to be doing moon missions and getting mountain exploring without leaving... basically an Earth-centric orbit.
So what you're saying is by 2020-ish, manned missions, human beings on our way to the moon.
Yes. We'll be doing exploration missions. In fact, the first real Orion mission, which is slated for 2021 or earlier, is either going to chase an asteroid or go out to Lagrange Point around the moon, or both. Mm-hmm. You know, so in the early 2020s, we'll be back out there exploring. And then I think the prevalent wisdom is in the 2030s. To 2050 timeframe is when we'll start trying to figure out how to get to Mars and how ambitious you want to be. If it's a simple flyby as your first mission, you know, you don't have to worry about landing, right?
Sure.
You can simplify this. You still have some tremendous challenges, the radiation. So when we sent the latest Mars rover, for the first time ever, we instrumented the ship that carried it out there. It was inside this, you know, shell, basically protecting it on the way to Mars. We instrumented it for radiation. And between Earth and Mars, there were three events that would have killed astronauts.
Whoops.
One would have cooked them in a matter of days. The other two probably would have returned them home to Earth extremely sick.
Seriously ill.
Yes. Hmm. And that actually happened on one of the Apollo missions. There was a solar flare, and they had to scramble them, get them home ahead of the solar flare. Because if they hadn't gotten into the Earth's magnetosphere, they would have been cooked as well coming back.
Yeah, I think I saw something like that in the movie Fantastic Four. Right?
Yeah, a little bit different, but you know.
So instead of the astronauts coming back as the thing and
right,
the human torch,
right.
They came back as normal humans. Okay, that was good. Well, this is all fascinating. In fact, this leads me to another question that I will get to about the Orion craft in particular, which is your area of expertise, and we'll do that here in just a moment. We'll take a little break. We'll be right back. This episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist is sponsored by baseball. Whether you love baseball or can't stand baseball, you have to admit, once you start hearing the crack of the bat and the spitting of the tobacco, you know that winter is almost over. Springtime, summertime on its way. Baseball. Just love it. Okay, back to the show. So thanks for hanging in there. This is Ask a Rocket Scientist. Okay, so next up, I have a question specifically from one of my children, my son Eddie, and he wants to know this.
Hey, Bill. So when I watch movies about the moon landing, it looks kind of crowded. And since the flight to Mars will be a lot longer, do you think it would be a little more spacious and they would have a little more room? And if so, how much room would they have?
So I love my children because they ask the questions that I want to ask. And I don't know what that says about me and my level of intellect, but I love my kids because I'm curious too. So Orion, which is your puppy, your speciality, that's what you're working on and have been for quite some time, is going to get us, as you said earlier, it's going to get us to the moon and then hopefully further off to Mars. So let's imagine a Mars trip, because we'd sat down and watched Apollo 13 and my kids had questions about the size of the ship and how three people can be in such a tight environment for such a long period of time, 5 or 6 days, however long they were out. Well, this is going to be 6 months at least out and then back, as we were talking, possibly 2 years. How big is the Orion craft? How many people are going to be on it? What kind of elbow room do you have? Is it like the space shuttle where you can see them having space to kind of move around in their own compartments, or is it a much tighter environment?
It's roomier than Apollo, but when we go to Mars, we're going to have another vehicle attached to Orion. You're not going to be living solely inside the capsule. That's just not feasible. It's too tight. So you'll have another living compartment bolted on or docked to it, basically. So it's a basic comparison. So Apollo, you know, we've all seen Apollo 13, or you have a kind of a feel for it. It's not huge. Apollo capsule is 12.8 feet in diameter. You know, so it's the size of
that's
a small
wee.
Bedroom.
That's
it,
wee.
It's
small. Way
it's small. Very small. It's the size of a small bedroom, right?
Just, you know, I went to Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. I've got a friend. His name's Rick. He works there. And they had a mock-up of an Apollo craft. They had this 3 seats side by side, and you could sit in it. I sat in with my two buddies. We are not astronaut size. We are much larger than astronauts. It was a very tight fit for the three of us. Yeah. It's not big at all. It's right. Like, imagine sitting at a dinner table, three people side by side.
Right, elbow to elbow, man.
4 days at a time.
Absolutely. Now, one thing, and you might have caught it in Apollo 13, they can reconfigure the interior so that they can go into the tunnel area. Mm-hmm. There's places where they can actually stretch out and be full, actually stand up, so to speak.
Yeah.
So you're not stuck in your seat the whole time. But you're right, they are tight. Remember, it's tough getting things to orbit. You can't be big and heavy. You have to be lean and mean.
Yeah. Luxury is not an option.
It is not. It definitely is not. So With Apollo, if I can't remember if the metric was based on total pressurized volume or the habitable volume that the astronauts could actually use, but they got 60 cubic feet of space per astronaut.
Okay.
Not a lot.
No.
You know, that's, you know.
That's a chair.
3 foot by 3 foot by, you know, what's that, 9 times 6, 6 by 6 feet. Yeah, that's not much, right? It's not a lot.
Can I tell you something, audience? This is really fun sitting here watching Bill do math. He's working at a level I can't even begin to comprehend, and he's just doing it off the top of his head. Please continue.
So, okay, so you got roughly 60 cubic feet per astronaut. Now, Orion, originally the concept was to carry 6 astronauts. NASA kind of envisions this exploration vehicle has different missions. So initially they said, well, we'd like to be able to carry 6, but on most missions, probably 4.
Okay.
And so when we laid it out for 6 astronauts, I believe they each got, was it 90 cubic feet each? So it gives you an idea, it's bigger.
Okay.
And so just to give you a couple quick numbers here. So Apollo, like I said, is 12.8 feet in diameter. Orion is 16.4 feet in diameter. So it's not drastically bigger as diameter goes, but the volume inside of it is about 2.5 times bigger.
Okay.
When you talk about the total pressurized volume. So there is more space in it. Now that's partially offset by the fact that Apollo had a very short mission duration. It could only go out for a couple of weeks. Yeah. It was powered solely by fuel cells. No solar panels. So most fuel cells are dead. Just like the shuttle. Shuttle was fuel cells only. Mm-hmm. Very short mission life. Orion has a nominal exploration mission of 21 days and has to be able to park itself for 6 months. Mm. Right. So yeah, it's bigger, but it also has to carry far more stores, more water, more food.
Sure.
Right. So it's not like you suddenly gain all this extra space for the astronauts to play around, and it's partially offset by storage lockers.
Yeah.
So, so for anybody who wants some actual numbers, so Apollo had about 218 cubic feet of habitable space.
Okay.
So, you know, if you had a 10 by 10 room, that's 100, that's 100 square feet on the floor, right? Yeah. Well, 200 total means it's only 2 feet high. I mean, obviously that's not a realistic measurement, but it gives you an idea. It's not a lot of volume total.
Yeah.
Orion has 316 cubic feet of habitable space. But the difference is we have almost 700 total pressurized. So the rest of that space is going towards storing things.
Sure, sure.
You know, be it food, water, whatever you're bringing back from an asteroid.
So I've seen footage, you know, most recently the International Space Station. We were talking about all the footage we would see with Scott Kelly up there. And then also I remember seeing lots of footage from the space shuttle program. Is Orion comparable to either of those? I mean, there's not enough room for you to be doing backflips and twists and things like that, right?
Definitely not. Okay. No. So the space station is large by comparison.
I guess so.
It's the astronauts liken it to a 4-bedroom house. So it actually, when you look at a picture of the space station, there's the big truss structure that holds everything. That's a football field long. Now that obviously isn't fully habitable.
Right.
The little habitable modules, you know, are attached to it kind of in the center. Mm-hmm. And I don't know an actual volume measurement, but again, like I said, okay. The astronauts kind of say it's about like a 4-bedroom house.
Gotcha. And this would be more like a 1-bedroom house?
Yes.
I mean, if you, okay.
On a good day. It's a studio, man. Day.
So then that brings up this question, because I'm not a small man. Are there a height and weight and size restrictions for astronauts who go into space? They have to be certain heights?
There are. Okay. And so the ergonomics in the vehicle are designed from, like when we look at the CAD, computer-aided design software, and we can sit there and look at it, you can actually load in astronauts of different sizes. So there's the 5th percentile female, and there's a 95th percentile male. And they've actually, the seats will actually stack over. When you have 4 astronauts, 2 astronauts are sitting over another 2 astronauts. They're not side by side like in the Apollo. They're okay. Kind of on 2 levels.
Got it.
And you can actually stack a 95th percentile male over a 5th percentile female, and they'll both fit.
Okay.
So you can have, you know, Andre the Giant over a very small person.
Yes.
Or next to each other, too. And that's one of the challenges now is that so you've got the pilot and the commander are sitting next to each other. Actually have to operate the vehicle. Those have to be sized up. 2 very disparate sized people can both operate mm-hmm. the vehicle got simultaneously. It. So it's a challenge, but they are pretty forgiving. I can't remember the max height. Is it 6'3", 6'5"? It's pretty generous as far as how tall you can be.
Okay. So it's not like, because I remember watching The Right Stuff. The original Mercury 7 astronauts, they were all small, right?
They were.
Like 5'6", 5'7", 5'8"?
Yes, very small vehicle too.
Yeah, it was really small. Tiny. All right, so here's another question for you. And this kind of goes along to my son's question. You're in a small confined space for 6 months as you get there. So what are you doing?
So that's a great question. So
are you just reading? I mean, I'm assuming you're taking
You do get personal time. Oh, absolutely.
And things like that. I'm sure that they're kind of like with Scott Kelly, they're monitoring your health with sensors and things like that. But
right. Right.
What are you doing?
So from the space station perspective, and a typical astronaut, and I'm just gleaning this from a Time magazine article, but they say typical astronaut follows about 30% of their time is devoted to science experiments, 40% is devoted to physical exercise, and monitoring the space station's systems, and then the remaining 30% is fixing hardware that needs fixing.
Got it.
And so within that, I mean, there's personal time, obviously, and you've got the exercise part is kind of critical because they found that, you know, again, with like we talked about earlier, with your body wanting to immediately go to lowest energy state because there's no gravity anymore.
Yeah, you start to atrophy.
You have to. So you have to put a lot of effort into exercising and doing things to try to maintain what you can. Mm-hmm. So that's a big part of it. And so obviously Orion, you know, isn't roomy enough to put a treadmill in or an exercise vehicle. So that's why there's going to have to be another habitable module that's docked to it that goes along for the ride. So they have a bigger space to...
Got it.
You know,
and is that habitable module going to be waiting for them? They have to dock into it in space, or is it going to launch with them?
Most likely it's going to be waiting for them. It's going to be launched on a separate rocket. I'm just thinking from the SLS perspective, like Apollo launched...
What does SLS stand for?
Space Launch System.
Thank you. So that's the rocket.
That's the new rocket.
It's the big giant thing that they're sitting on top of.
Big Mac Daddy rocket. It's the size of a Saturn
V. It's like the old Apollo Saturn V.
It is.
Okay, gotcha.
Except it's about the same height, but it will eventually have a lot more lift capacity.
Gotcha. So okay. I didn't mean to derail you.
No, it's all good. It's all good. And I forgot what we were talking about.
Well, that's too bad.
Great derailing, man.
Now you
okay.
look like an idiot. So what you're saying is the SLS is going to be able to launch the ship, the Orion,
right.
into orbit, and
right.
then we'll dock with...
Right. If you have to piece together a lot of pieces, you're going to have to do it in separate launches. Apollo took up I think the command module is the kind of the conical mm-hmm. part you see the astronauts sitting at. The top part, right? The cylinder behind it's called the service module. And then they also had a lander.
The lunar module.
The lunar lander, right?
Yeah.
And all that was packed onto a single
rocket.
And then rocket.
For a while there, they had a car.
That was actually packed inside the lunar lander.
Isn't that crazy? They took a car.
And if you've ever, for example, if you go to the Kennedy Space Center and go to the museum, that actually didn't look like a car packed into the service module, the lunar lander. It's folded up. Yeah. They actually had to unfold it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, everything's, yeah, they had to fit in small space.
And this gets to your point where everything needs to be streamlined. I mean, this isn't just like you load up the RV with a whole bunch of supplies and you're going to drive across the country here in the U.S.,
right.
It's like you can't do that.
Right.
You have to meticulously say, okay, we can take X amount of pounds up, and then we have to meticulously figure out how much does all this weigh. And
exactly. Know. There's no like, we're close enough. It doesn't work. You know, if you don't get to orbit right, you're not going anywhere beyond it, and it's a lot of money flushed.
Okay, so getting back to you're sitting in a ship. with three other people that eventually you're going to grow to hate because it's just human nature, right? And so you're trapped for, let's say, just the trip up. Because once you get up there, then all of a sudden it's shiny happy time because you're at Mars. And so it gets more exciting. But for that 6 months, like, you're just reading books? I mean, I'm assuming that, you know, you'll have internet connection or you'll be able to talk back to Earth and talk to your loved ones and things.
I think you'll have access. The further you get from Mars, the bigger the lag.
Of course, yeah.
Right, so you're going to say something into a, you know,
telephone. 23 minutes later.
Right, you know, exactly, because by the time you're on Mars, it is...
I saw The Martian.
You know what I'm talking about here. Yeah, I mean, there's a serious lag. By the time you're on Mars, you can't really have real-time back-and-forth conversations. Mm-hmm. The Martian actually is a good starting point for this, because I'd have to imagine... You know, like, they had all their digital media up there with them.
Yes.
You know, they had, you know, things to read, things to watch, probably very similar.
Okay, so in your leisure time, you're pretty much using the media that you bring up with you, like we saw in The Martian. As far as food and drink goes, obviously, they're just packets that are, like, is there any, I mean, I'm familiar with the old Apollo meals, you know, the little freeze-dried stuff, the little packets that you can buy at the Science Space Museum or whatever.
Right.
I'm assuming we've evolved beyond that. Or is it still kind of just powdered Tang? And
I think it's better than that, but it is still limited. I mean, obviously, you don't have fresh food. Like on the space station, when they have a service, a supply module shows up, there's always a little bit of fresh food, which is kind of a treat for the astronauts. But you know, you can't live off that.
Can't store it.
Can't store it.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a challenge. You've got to bring up things that are very, very long lived. water on the space station, they recycle all the water. So they recycle urine, sweat, everything that goes through water purification, and that's what they drink.
Just reuse it.
Yeah, reuse it, right, because you can't get rid of it. Water is extremely heavy. You can't just tank up more water.
Yeah.
You know, it's very costly. So when you leave for Mars, you're starting with what you've got. Mm-hmm. That's it. There's no gas station on the way, no gas and sip to, you know, grab a Snickers. So you have to reuse.
That'd be a great business idea, though.
No, if you were not the truck stop on the halfway point.
Exactly.
Mars or bust, right here.
Uh-huh. Yeah. last exit for the next 20 million miles.
Exactly.
Okay, well, so then that brings me to another question about staying alive on a long flight, and we will address that question after this. This episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist is sponsored by those little plastic things at the end of your shoelaces. You know, they kind of keep them contained. They take the edge of the shoelace and then they bunch it all up in the tight plastic so it's able to go through the eyelet of your shoe, little holes. Little do you know how important those are until they snap off and break and crack, and all of a sudden you got a frayed shoelace. You're trying to shove it. Yeah, it's just a pain trying to shove it through that hole. Yeah, so little plastic things at the end of your shoelaces, oh, so incredibly important. All right, back to the episode. Welcome back to Ask a Rocket Scientist. I'm Chuck, here with Bill. And so, continuing our conversation about traveling to Mars, what I want to know, okay, so the very first space travel movie I saw when I was young, other than Star Wars, I remember seeing Planet of the Apes, and I remember seeing Alien. And in both of those movies, the astronauts are put in suspended animation. They're put in a little sarcophagus, sealed up, then they fall asleep, and apparently thousands of years later... Or hundreds of years or years later, they wake up and everything's fine.
Right.
What's the deal there? So is that science or is that not science?
It's not science today. I've read articles that talk about how they're working on what can you do. So there's a very real need for something like that because you can't bring a lot of food with you on these missions. How do you get enough food on board to go on a very long duration mission?
Yeah.
Well, if you can reduce what the body needs in the form of less oxygen, less food, less water, obviously you can go a lot further. So how do you slow down the metabolic processes of the body to try to minimize what you have to bring with you?
Right.
And so that's where these come from. And it's a real easy way in science fiction movies to explain how you could, you know, go for a year trip and not need any food and whatnot. So, okay.
Well, you just slow your heartbeat down. You won't age.
Pretty much. Yeah, exactly. In the movies, they don't age. They're perfectly frozen or suspended.
And they wake up full of vim and vigor and ready to battle
aliens.
Exactly.
Ready to fight aliens. I know. That's how it works. I saw aliens. that's the premise. Right now, we do not have that.
Conceptually? I mean,
I think the theory is sound. You read about articles about how they're trying to figure out how to do this, and I'm sure that they've tried to freeze, you know, organic tissue, either animal or vegetable or mineral, whatever, just to see if they can bring them back. And we all know with vegetables, you can freeze a vegetable in the freezer in your house, and it comes back out and tastes.
It's still edible, still nutritious. Edible.
Right, right. But it's not actually a living, breathing organism. So, I mean, it's quite a bit more difficult to take a
It's organic, but it's not still alive.
Exactly. So you think about some of the challenges. Well, freezing might not be the most correct sense, because when you freeze something, the fluid expands. Well, you don't want to, if you froze your body, what happens if your blood expands and freezes and bad things would happen?
I'm guessing that wouldn't be good.
That probably wouldn't be the best way to go now. So I'd imagine that in reality, the process would be a little bit different than just simply freezing somebody. Unless the Star Wars approach of freezing Han Solo and carbonite works.
We should look into that.
Freezing works there. But,
well, what's great is with the carbonite thing, I mean, they just thawed him like that. It was instantaneous, and he was fine. He was a little drowsy.
That's right.
A little weak in the knees.
It took a little time for his eyes to come back afterward.
He rebounded pretty quick.
He did, so.
Took care of Boba Fett.
Right. Again, these darn science fiction movies make everything so easy. Huh. I think, if we ever want to go great distances, we're going to have to figure out something along those lines, because you can't. Your basic problems are you're getting away from the sun, so you don't have power, you don't have solar anymore, right? So there goes that means of energy. So you've got to go nuclear. You've got a food and water problem. You can't just bring an infinite amount of food and water with you.
Sure.
So
kind of going forward, let's project out, 100 years, a couple hundred years. We get to Mars, we're fine there. We want to go out to the moons of Jupiter or Saturn or something like that.
Right.
Much longer
trip.
Much longer trip.
Yes.
So if we were to attempt that, if we had the technology and the rocket power and whatnot to get us to Saturn today, we probably couldn't do it because of that issue.
Exactly.
Because you'd need to have about 15, 18 wheelers patched up behind you, loaded down with gear and food.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, because you're talking years and years to get there. Yeah. And that means that much food.
And you can't really... it's not a Mark Watney situation where you can build your own garden on the craft, right? I mean, because I've seen science fiction movies where they do have greenhouses.
They do. And they've tried on the space station to grow some crops. Not mass scale that they could actually survive off of. But they've tried growing things. And plants do grow in space. Mm-hmm. But then you've got the problem is like, okay, well, we can't haul soil up. That's heavy. It takes a lot of space, right? Yeah. So then it's hydroponic. And it's plausible, but again, it takes space. It takes, it's not an easy thing. So all these are challenges for the Mars mission, in fact, because they're trying to figure out, we've got the radiation problem, we've got power problems, you've got how are you going to feed people? How do you keep from going crazy in a small space? You've got, all these things are very real issues that are going to have to be addressed before we go, commit to trying to get out to Mars. 142 million miles away, it's or from the sun, might be from the sun. I think it's 142 million miles from the sun, whereas Earth is 95 million miles from the sun.
So it's not just a day trip.
No.
This is a massive commitment of time, energy, resources, which brings us back to Scott Kelly and why it was so important for him to spend a year in space.
Precisely. It's the first step. Just like Orion is the first step for a vehicle that's going to go to Mars, Scott Kelly is the first step in us gathering some data to say, how can we protect our astronauts? How can we make sure that they are okay?
Okay, so as we're watching movies like Alien, Planet of the Apes, suspended animation, science or not science? Not science right now, but possibly science?
I think it's plausible. I don't think anyone's ever said, hey, this is just a ridiculous idea. We haven't gotten to the point where we can definitively say, okay, how would we do it? We know, for example, when people fall through the ice, their metabolism slows tremendously, and that's why they survive.
Yeah.
So obviously obviously you don't want to freeze people like that.
Well, that's what happened to Captain America.
Exactly.
70 years later, he was just fine.
He's a superhero popsicle. but along the lines that we in our own experience today, we know that there are things that can happen to the human body that do slow its metabolism down. We just would need to simulate that in a less violent way.
Yeah.
To do it. But it's plausible that we can slow down the metabolism. Maybe not stop it completely, maybe not quite.
So you don't want to just attach oxygen masks to people and then open up one of the doors in space and just freeze everybody.
No, that would be brutal.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we've nailed it down that as far as suspended animation goes right now, definitely not science. With potential. Yeah, maybe with potential?
Yeah, I like I said, I think it's plausible, just not okay. not in, you know, next in the imminent future, but you know, over gotcha. Time, I think eventually we will figure things out that can help us go further away from Earth.
By the time we're traveling to other solar systems to attack aliens,
right, you know, Independence Day sort of thing. Yeah, we got perfect. To, okay, great. Good, some payback.
Okay, so brings us to this point of the show where we figure out what is it that we learned today. What did we learn today, Bill? What are some things that we learned?
We've learned that traveling to space is hard.
Traveling to space
it's hard
is
on
hard.
Humans because we are singularly designed to live in gravity, and space doesn't have any. So there's the challenges. You got to figure out the physiological and psychological aspects of how do humans survive.
I think the most important thing that we need to figure out is the psychological, because I think we can figure out the human body. We've kind of got that figured out. We know what our heart rate needs to be, and we know how to exercise. We know how to do these things, but how do we prevent people from completely flipping out?
Yeah. Yeah, you got to pick judiciously when you're going to send people on a mission that's going to be out there for that long.
Which is why it's so funny that the you know those news articles you would see where people are volunteering to one-way missions to Mars. It's like, I don't know if I want to be on a ship with people that know it's a one-way trip to Mars.
Right.
Because then it's just total anarchy.
nothing to lose.
Nothing to live for. There's no reason to keep anybody else alive on the ship.
Right. As soon as the chocolate runs out, then it's just bad juju.
It's bedlam. It's anarchy. It would make a great film.
It's like dogs and cats living together.
Mass hysteria. Okay, so I think we learned that. We also learned that that when you do go into space, you have to recycle your urine. That's news to me.
We do.
That counts me out of the trip. And also suspended animation is bunk. All right, so I think that's what we've learned today. All right, let's talk about resource materials, because there's a lot of stuff out there available. If people that are listening to this want to learn more about Scott Kelly or traveling to Mars... What would you recommend?
Right. You know, I hate to use the simple go Google it, but Google does know a lot. Time Magazine they actually covered Scott Kelly's mission in a fair amount of detail. They had many updates. So that
didn't
might
they
be,
do like a big thing before he went?
They did.
Kind of what to expect?
They did.
And
absolutely.
It'd be interesting to read that and then follow through now. Well, you've got it handy.
I do. So
Bill, you're the man.
I got it right here, as a matter of fact. So it was the double issue from December 29th, 2014, and January 5th, 2015.
So if you can't find this, just reach out to Bill.
That's right. That's why I got it sitting right here on my table. Yeah. Right, exactly. And then on his return, every news outlet has got snippets of you know his return and you know what's he going through right now. Mm-hmm. But if you want to think about the challenges in space, though, there's a book written by Mary Roach called Packing for Mars.
It's a great book.
Fantastic book. And she, in very real terms, talks about, here's the challenges that face humans when they try to go into space. And it breaks it down very simply into chapters of, okay, the psychological aspect. Mm-hmm. How do you go to the bathroom in space?
Yeah.
You know, things that people always have these questions about but don't necessarily ask.
One of the most fascinating things in the book, and we're going to talk about in a future episode, what happens if you vomit in your spacesuit?
Right.
Because it's possible.
It's quite possible.
You get motion sickness?
Yeah.
It's not good.
No.
You vomit in your spacesuit.
Things go badly.
So if you're a fan of the podcast, keep listening because we're going to get to that eventually. There's a little tease for you. All right. Fantastic. Well, Bill, I cannot thank you enough for sitting down with us again today. We'll do this again very, very soon. Thank you so much for your knowledge. And
you're most welcome, Chuck.
Being part of the fun. And thank you for tuning in. We sure do appreciate it. Another episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist in the Can. We'll be back next time. Thanks.
Ask a Rocket Scientist could be brought to you by you. Get your product or service the attention it deserves on a high-quality professional podcast. For more info, go to iHeartRocketScience.com.